The study of economics most often deals with markets where goods are bought and sold, and the price of the good is the chief influence. But how do markets handle goods that can't be bought? Alvin Roth, co-recipient of the 2012 Nobel Prize in Economics, examines those markets in a new book titled Who Gets What and Why. He joins us from our studios at WGBH in Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
So when we think about markets, most of us immediately think of purchasing, using money to get the things that we want. But there are some things that money can't buy, and economists have a term for that, a matching market. So tell us about matching markets, and maybe you can give us some examples.
Okay. Well, matching markets aren't just about things that money can't buy, but they're about markets in which money doesn't do all the work. So there are some things that money simply can't buy. You can't buy a kidney for transplant. It's against the law, and we can talk about how people can nevertheless exchange kidneys. But there are lots of things that you can't merely buy. You don't get a job at a radio station by simply agreeing to work for the wage. You have to be hired. You don't get admitted to Harvard by being willing to pay the tuition. You have to be admitted. So there are lots of markets in which prices may be important. Money may be used, but the price doesn't adjust so that supply equals demand. Harvard doesn't fill its freshman class by raising the tuition until just enough high school graduates want to attend. It's expensive to go to Harvard, but it's cheap enough so that lots of people would like to do it. And that's why there are all these other market institutions, applications and admissions and interviews and essays. So there are lots of markets in which you can't just choose what you want. You also have to be chosen. And those are matching markets.
So, and it's your belief that successful matching marketplaces have three main qualities: thickness, lack of congestion, and reliability. So can you elaborate on each of these and why they're important?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that those apply not just to matching markets, but to all marketplaces. To make the market work well, a marketplace has to help it be thick. It has to attract enough people to come together so that they can transact with each other. And that's true even of commodity markets like the Chicago Board of Trade or the New York Stock Exchange, where you don't care who you're matched with. But then once you have a thick market, you have to deal with congestion. That is, there are lots of people at the market and lots of possible transactions to evaluate. And dealing with congestion is tougher for matching markets than it is for commodity markets, because in a commodity market, you can make your offer to the whole market. I would like to buy a ton of coal. I would like to buy 5,000 bushels of wheat. But in a matching market, you often make your offers to individuals. I would like to hire you. Would you like a job at my firm? We would like to admit you to our university. And so if there are lots of people who you have to make offers to, and you have, say, you can't admit more freshmen than a certain number, then if some freshmen who you make offers to turn you down, then you have to make offers to new people. And that process can take time, and you might start anticipating how you're going to manage it, because if you can't manage it well, the market will suffer from congestion. You won't get the benefit of the thickness, the fact that there are lots of transactions you could do if there are too many for you to consider and process. And then markets have to be safe to participate in. If you're on the internet and you want to buy something, you have to feel it's safe to give your credit card information. If you're trying to get your kid into school and the school district asks you to rank the schools, what would be your first choice? What would be your second choice? What would be your third? You have to feel it's safe to tell them that they won't penalize you by giving you a bad school if you fail to get the school you name as your first choice. Mm. That's actually a problem that we see in a lot of American cities, and my colleagues and I have been trying to change the way school choice is done for that reason, that it's not safe to confide in the school district sometimes what schools you would like. Of course, it's very difficult to give people the schools they would like if they don't feel safe to confide that information.
Yeah. Let's talk about a marketplace that doesn't use money. You mentioned kidney donations. It's long been the case that individuals with kidney failure are put on the list for a cadaver kidney, or they have to hunt for a compatible and willing donor. It's often a long and painful process. You helped design a matching market for kidney exchanges. Tell us more about how this works.
Okay. Well, as you say, you can get a kidney from a living donor. That's because you have two kidneys, and if you're healthy enough, you can stay healthy with just one kidney, and that means you can donate a kidney to someone you love who needs a kidney, and you can save their life. But sometimes you're healthy enough to give a kidney, but you can't give it to the person you love, because kidneys have to be well matched to their recipients. So you might be healthy enough to give a kidney, but be incompatible with your intended recipient, with the person you love who needs a kidney. And in the old days, the hospital would just send you home. They'd say, thank you very much, you're incompatible, and that would be the end of it. You would vanish from the scene. But what kidney exchange is it's a way to still get the person you love a kidney. And the way that works is, supposing you have an incompatible patient who you would like to donate to, and I might be in the same situation, so I can't donate to my patient and you can't donate to your patient. But maybe my kidney matches your patient and your kidney matches my patient. So we can each get a kidney for the person we love by giving a kidney. I give a kidney to the person you love and you give a kidney to the person I love. That's the simplest form of kidney exchange. And no money changes hands, so it obeys the law. It's against the law in the United States and almost everywhere in the world. It's against the law to pay for a kidney. But it's clearly an economic process. There's an exchange going on. We mutually benefit by exchanging, and that's what exchange is about in economics. Mm.
So what are some of the challenges for these two- or three-way exchanges then?
Well, because you can't write a contract on a kidney, the law that makes it illegal to pay for a kidney says you can't give valuable consideration for a kidney. You can't write a contract. We can't write a contract that says we'll give you a kidney today and you give us a kidney tomorrow. And of course, it would really harm a pair that gave a kidney and then didn't get one, because not only would they have had a surgery that didn't benefit them, but they would no longer have a kidney to exchange. So when we look for the next exchanges, they wouldn't be able to participate. So we always do those exchanges, those simple exchanges, where one pair exchanges with another pair or where three pairs exchange among themselves. We always do them simultaneously. Mm. But that poses logistical challenges, because even a simple two-way exchange now requires four simultaneous operating rooms and four simultaneous surgical teams for the two nephrectomies, taking the kidney out, and the two transplants, putting the kidney in. And so when you do a three-way exchange, that requires six operating rooms and surgical teams. So it gets hard to do larger exchanges. Mm. And so more and more, we've come to depend on chains that are started with a non-directed donor, because the fact that we can do those non-simultaneously, arranging them so that every pair gets a kidney before they give one, so that if the chain breaks, there's not a tragic loss. The fact that we can do that means that we can sometimes do a whole lot of transplants initiated by a single non-directed donor who starts off a chain.
Hmm. Was it difficult to get hospitals and doctors on board with this new approach to kidney donations?
Well, kidney exchange was something that doctors actually developed without the help of economists, but they were doing it on a very small scale because it's very difficult to find pairs who can exchange with each other and because of all these logistical difficulties. And so what my economist colleagues and I did in helping our surgical colleagues to organize kidney exchange was to organize it on a large scale, to make the marketplace thick by forming databases of incompatible patient-donor pairs, to deal with congestion by breaking the need for simultaneity, and by allowing larger exchanges to be done, and to make it safe to participate in, to reveal the information necessary to determine what are good matches of kidneys.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned it's illegal to buy or sell human organs, but money is certainly part of the kidney exchanges because hospitals make profits on these procedures. And you write in your book, this resulted in hospitals not enrolling their easy-to-match patient-donor pairs in the larger kidney exchange programs because they want to do the exchanges in-house and profit from both surgeries. So explain why this practice ends up hurting the larger exchange and how the market might have to adapt to this development.
Well, there are definitely problems with financing kidneys, but there's also logistical problems. It's a little harder to do multi-hospital exchanges than it is to do in-house exchanges. And so there's now a tendency, as you say, among big transplant centers to do, now that they've learned to do kidney exchange, to do easy exchanges with easy-to-match pairs internally, and then to show the multi-hospital exchanges only their hard-to-match pairs. The reason that's not good for patients in general, first, it's clearly not good for the hard-to-match pairs because the easiest way to match a hard-to-match pair is to match them with an easy-to-match pair. Hard-to-match pairs are hard to match with each other. What does it mean to be a hard-to-match pair? One thing it might mean is that the patient is highly sensitized. That means the patient can hardly take anybody's kidney, even when they're of the right blood type. And the way that happens is if you've had a previous kidney transplant or if you've had a lot of blood transfusions, you develop a lot of antibodies to human proteins. And that means your immune system might be ready to attack my kidney if it should show up. So even though my kidney looks like it would otherwise be compatible with you because of your body's past exposure to some of the proteins that I have, you can't take my kidney. And that can happen not just with people who are sick. For instance, the chance that you could take my kidney is probably somewhat above 50%. But the chance that my wife can take my kidney is closer to 30%. And that's because my wife and I are parents. And in the course of childbirth, my wife's immune system might have become exposed to some of the proteins that our boys inherit from me. Mm. And in that case, she might have antibodies that would be poised to attack my kidney if it showed up. So I might be pretty healthy and can give kidneys to lots of people, but not to my wife. Mm. But if she only has the antibodies she got in childbirth, then we could still be a very easy-to-match pair. Mm. There might be another incompatible patient-donor pair like that in the same big hospital that we're associated with, and they would say to us, why don't you guys just match with each other? Hmm. Now, the reason that might be a disadvantage for us is it might be that if we looked at the larger pool, we could find a better match. Mm-hmm. When you think about this is true even if patients and donors are not incompatible. You know, it turns out that if I needed a kidney, the people who love me enough to give me a kidney are probably all around my age. You know, there's my wife and my brother and my wife's brother. And of course, a kidney like that would save my life. It would be great. But at the same time, there might be some, I'm in my 60s, there might be some 25-year-old pair where the donor is an Olympic athlete and, you know, has a wonderful kidney. But they're incompatible. They need a kidney and they don't have one. And so my brother-in-law's kidney would work great for them. It would save their life. And you know, the 25-year-old kidney would be even better for me than my brother-in-law's kidney. Mm. So when big transplant centers rush to do exchanges and transplants internally, they might also be shortchanging the easy-to-match pairs who they match.
Right.
So it would be nice if we could make it sufficiently safe and simple for hospitals to participate so that they would naturally want to enroll all their patients. Mm-hmm. And we're not quite there yet.
We're talking with Alvin Roth. His book is Who Gets What and Why? We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Alvin Roth. His book is Who Gets What and Why? Now, markets, even matching markets, evolve over time. So talk a little bit about the importance of adjustments to the markets as they evolve.
Well, that's a good question. The people change their behavior based on the markets that appear. Think about Uber or Airbnb. When they started, they were looking for, you know, intrepid early adopters. And now they're trying to accommodate habitual travelers and people who might not previously have thought about using those things, and they have to adapt. With kidney exchange, when we started, kidney exchange was a new thing, and we were mostly dealing with individual surgeons and their patients. Now we're dealing with the directors of transplant centers who have different kinds of strategic options. A surgeon sees a patient. A director of a transplant center sees lots of patients and can decide which ones to show to us and which not. So you have to change the way you interact with people who have different kinds of strategies. This is true of financial markets, too. Nowadays, a lot of markets, not just the ones we consumers use on the internet, but a lot of markets are run by computers. And there's been a lot of talk of the fact that computerized trading can be very high-speed trading and that the existing rules for markets, continuous double auctions where the first person to take an order gets it, might now be causing people to compete on speed rather than on price. Mm. So there's an economist named Eric Budish at the University of Chicago who's been looking a lot at this and saying maybe given the availability of high-speed trading, we should tweak the rules of the market to encourage competition on price rather than on speed.
Mm. Now, you mentioned school choice. Another market you work to improve involved matching students with schools and cities that employ a school choice system. First, tell us the deficiencies in the old matching system, and then maybe you can explain how you improved the match system.
Okay. Well, let's start with cities that don't have school choice, right? So one time-tested way of assigning children to schools. You ask them where they live and you send them to the closest school. The reason a lot of cities are becoming unhappy with that is it means that people who, children who grow up in poor neighborhoods often go to poor schools. It's harder to organize good schools in the poorest neighborhoods. And if you give them some choice in schools, then maybe those schools will become smaller and easier to fix or easier to close and replace with better schools. And in the meantime, children can go to better performing schools further away. So we'd like to see some choice to give children equal opportunity to go to good schools. But it's hard to organize choice. And one system that we've seen in lots of cities, including including Boston before my colleagues and I helped them change some of the mechanics of their system, works as follows. It says, let's have all the families rank order the schools. Tell us your first choice, your second choice, your third choice. Then we'll try to give as many people as possible their first choice. Of course, some schools will be the first choice of more people than the school has capacity for. So we'll develop a system of priorities to be used in that situation to decide when more children want to go to a school than can, which ones will be able to go. So, for example, the first priority might be children who have an older sibling who already goes to that school. That way the parents will just have one drop-off in the morning. And a second priority, at least for some seats in the school, might be for children who live close to the school so they can walk to school. And the third priority might be a random tie-breaking number. Everyone might be given a lottery number, and when we have to break ties, the people with the better lottery numbers get the seats. So the way school choice went is you try to give as many people as possible their first choice using the priorities to tie-break. And then you look at everyone who's left, and you give as many as possible their second choice, and then you give as many people as possible their third choice. So that's very easy to describe, and it's clearly very benign in intent. The reason it's not a good system is if you don't get your first choice, there's an excellent chance that your second choice will have all its seats filled with people who listed it as their first choice, and your third choice will be filled with all the people who listed it as their first and second choice. So if you don't get your first choice, you might drop all the way through the system and have to send your kid to a school that still had seats available after everyone else had gotten their choice. And that might not be the best school. And what that means is you can't, it's not safe for you to tell the school district what's your first choice. Instead, you have to strategize. You have to think, what's the best school that I can get by saying that it's my first choice? Because if you don't get your first choice, you might really come to harm. And as a result, parents have to have all this risk, and they have to think not about where they want their kids to go necessarily, but where they think they can get their kids in. And that makes it hard to know where to send the kids because you don't know where the parents really want them to go. So right now in Boston and in New York and in a number of other cities, New Orleans and Denver and Washington, D.C., my colleagues and I have helped replace that kind of system with systems in which it is safe to tell the school district what your choices are. And the manner in which it's safe is that your chance of getting your second choice in case you fail to get your first choice is just as good as if you had listed it as your first choice. So you don't lose your priority the way you did in that system I just described to you, that you know you might have really high priority for your second choice. You might have another child who already goes there, so your child will have the older sibling priority. But if you don't list that school as your first choice, you won't get it because it'll be filled with people who listed it as their first choice. So under the new system, which is organized around what's called a deferred acceptance algorithm, that risk goes away. If you don't get your first choice, the fact that your child has sibling priority at your second choice will allow him to go there, and someone else will have to look at a subsequent choice. So you can safely indicate that even though it would be really convenient to have your second child go to the same school as your first child, your second child has a particular interest in art or in sports or whatever, and so you would really like her to go to a different school. That's a safe thing for you to indicate now, and as a result, the school district has some chance of giving you what you want and matching your child to a school that will work well for her.
You also talk about the unraveling of markets in your book. What is unraveling and what are some of the causes?
Yeah. Well, remember that one of the things a marketplace has to do to make a market successful is to make the market thick. And one way that markets do that, think of the New York Stock Exchange, they specify a time at which the market opens, right? You can't trade before 9 a.m. And that makes the market thick. You don't have to try to trade with people who might be not ready to trade, and you know when to come. You can see that even when you go to a farmer's market. The sellers will be reluctant to sell to you while they're setting up. There's a time at which the market is supposed to start. And it works to their advantage for people to know that so that they can sell in a few hours to lots of people instead of having to sell to the same people over many more hours. Well, in matching markets, what you want for the market to be thick is you want people to have a lot of choices. If it's a labor market for jobs, you want to know what choices – you want to be able to make choices among the jobs that might want to hire you. One way that employers can compete with each other is by trying to make job offers early. So if there's some day at which – before which job offers aren't supposed to be made, and the day before that day I make you an offer and I say to you, you have to say yes or no today, then I'm facing you with a tough choice because you – maybe I have a pretty attractive job, but it's not the best job you hope to get. You still have to decide whether to say yes or no to me without knowing what jobs you would get if you waited for the market. And if you say yes to me, then someone who might have hired you and you might have preferred will be disappointed, and next year they might go early too. Mm. And so there are some markets that go very early. Right now, if you know someone in law school, one of the things they can aspire to, one of the fancy first jobs for a new lawyer, is to be the law clerk of an appellate court judge. Now, that's a job that they'll take after they graduate from 3 years of law school. But right now, they'll get those jobs early in their second year because the judges have been competing with each other for mm-hmm. good clerks by going earlier and earlier. And there are a lot of costs to that. One is the students may not really know what kind of law they want to do and what judges they might hope to clerk for. And the judges don't really know how good the students are at the beginning of their second year. They've only finished 1 year of law school then instead of 2 years, say, if they were being hired at the beginning of their third year. So there are a lot of mismatches, and the judges make exploding offers. When you interview with a judge, he is likely to make you an offer on the spot to which you have to say yes or no, and often to which you have to say yes. You have to have agreed to say yes if he makes you an offer in order to get the interview. So that means people who get clerkships often only get to entertain one offer. And they have to take the first offer they get. And the same thing happened in medicine years ago. In the 1940s, medical students were taking their first job, an internship or residency. Their first job is a job that they would take after their fourth year of medical school, but they were also getting it after their second year of medical school. And that also caused lots of problems. You could be a second-year medical student, and you got an A in anatomy, and you think, I want to be a surgeon. And the summer after your second year is when the job market opens and you get a great surgery job. And in your third year, that's the first time you actually get to attend surgeries, and you discover you faint at the sight of blood or something like that. Well, you're not going to be a good surgeon, and the surgeon who hired you is going to be disappointed, and you're going to be disappointed. You would have rather waited and gotten a job later, but you weren't able to back then. But nowadays, a much better medical marketplace exists. It's a centralized clearinghouse that waits until the third, you know, the fourth year of medical school, and allows people to rank order the various jobs that they're considering, so that they really have an opportunity to consider all the jobs that will consider them. And that's very similar. It turns out the medical match and the school choice systems that we've been talking about operate on very similar mathematical algorithms.
Yeah. Something I wrote in the book, this really surprised me. Some private schools even enroll students at birth. At Wetherby School in England, a school Princes William and Harry attended, the spaces reserved by newborns fill up early each month, and the school advises women scheduling cesarean sections to have them on the first of the month, if possible, to get a place before all the spots are gone. Wow.
Yeah. Well, I agree. But, you know, I think that in Manhattan, there are some preschools that have almost as fierce competition.
Is that right? Wow. Well, in the instance of the hospital resident matching market, it was a resident, Hardy Hendren, who realized the unraveling of the market was hurting residents and proposed a design that improved the market. And you've been brought in to help redesign other failing markets, as you mentioned, the school choice match system and later a version of the medical match system as well, which, as you just said, they're sort of similar.
They are. So there's a very a very nice paper written in 1962 by David Gale and Lloyd Shapley. And they called their, it was a theory paper. They weren't thinking of any particular markets, but they called their paper College Admissions and the Stability of Marriage. And they laid out some of the basic game theory of this kind of problem, without knowing that 10 years earlier, more than 10 years earlier, medical administrators and a committee of medical students had hit on a similar kind of clearinghouse for the doctors, and Hardy Hendren was involved in that. He later became a famous surgeon at Massachusetts General Hospital, and that worked really fine for a long time. The clearinghouse that the doctors built for themselves in the 1950s. But one of the things about matching in the 1950s was medical graduates, students in American medical schools, were virtually all men. And by the 1970s, there were about 10% of medical graduates were women, and some of the men and women graduates were married to each other. Today, today about 50% of medical students in the United States are women, and there are about 16 or 17,000 graduates a year, and something like 1,800 or 1,900 of them are married to each other, 800 or 900 or a little more couples. So couples looking for jobs have a tougher problem. They would like to find – they need two jobs, not just one, and they would like to find two jobs near each other where they can continue to live as a couple. So that turns out to be a tough mathematical problem, and some of my work was – so I got to redesign the algorithm for the medical match in the 1990s. And that was one of the focuses of my work, how to handle couples gracefully.
In your experience, do markets eventually correct themselves, or are there chronic deficiencies in markets that are just too difficult or entrenched to change?
So eventually could be a very long time. So I would hate to say that markets will never correct themselves. But the market for doctors unraveled from and had other problems. It had problems with congestion once they figured out the unraveling. From 1900 to 1950, it worked rather poorly. And then in 1950, in the early 50s, they developed this centralized clearinghouse that has since worked very well. So that's a case where maybe in the intermediate term, the market corrected itself. But it worked for 50 years, and of course, that's 50 graduating classes of doctors. There are markets that work badly for much longer than that. Think how difficult it is to redesign aspects of the American healthcare system, right? There are, you know, some work splendidly, some work less than splendidly, but they're all embedded in the complicated existing system that makes it hard to make changes. You know, when you talk about designing a market, about redesigning a market, you're not talking about starting from a blank slate. You're talking about making incremental improvements, and these are improvements that have to be made in light of the fact that people have already made investments in technologies and institutions and careers using the old rules of the market. So a lot of change is only incremental and can take a long time.
The book is titled Who Gets What and Why. Alvin Roth, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Thanks to Tom Devlin and John Parker for production assistance in Boston.